You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
The Athletic.
All right, Reds, Tony Evans here, but walk on, your Liverpool podcast brought to you by The Athletic. It's been a pretty miserable season. No trophies, no Champions League football for next season, and no Jude Bellingham this summer. So, to cheer us all up, we've come to the pub to huddle together and pick through the bones of the season and where things have gone wrong for the Reds and how they fix it this summer. To get stuck into it, we've got James Pearce, Kiefer O'Neill, and making his long-awaited return, drum roll, Simon Hughes.
Woohoo!
But let's start with those three words. Kiefer.
We're in the pub. That's four. I don't care.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, in the pub?
Yeah, in the pub. In the pub will do.
Proper work stuff, this.
It's nearly over.
Well, hopefully this session in the pub isn't. But anyway, let's see what they're saying on the Walk On Facebook page. John Weller says, long season ends. Atlim Lowe says, major rebuild required. Lavon Eldon, ready for signings. And Shane Roche, early signings, please. Okay, Simon, three words for you. Where have you been?
Well, I've been on a paternity leave. My wife gave birth to a boy earlier this year, so...
Congratulations.
Thank you, yeah, thank you. Two is much, much harder than one, I can confirm that. So a bit of sleep deprivation at the moment, but everybody's fit and healthy anyway, so sounds like a bit of a footballer's answer that, doesn't it? But
Well, now you've got one for each of the women's and men's teams.
I know. Well, my daughter's shown quite a bit of interest in football, actually.
We'd love to see it.
Yeah, well... Vincent as well, the lads, every time I put the footy on, he's like, he sort of perks up and he's like watching what's going on. So I think it's the green, you know, the colour of the pitch that they sort of are attracted to. But
can't be the standard of the football
this
season.
No, it can't be. I watched the 7-0 United game with my daughter and she was just found it hilarious every time a goal went in. So that was quite a nice experience.
It was hilarious. So.
Yeah, it was a nice experience to watch that game with her, I must say, yeah.
Yeah, and I noticed on Twitter over the weekend you were in Bavaria, pitch invading.
Yeah.
Ban an order.
I know. Well, yeah, so in the middle of this paternity leave, my mate Mark decides to have a stag do. He's getting married in a few months' time. So, we went to Munich. And I was arranging this stag, so there was a couple of options, and obviously, naturally, you're going to gravitate towards buying, but we struggled to get 10 of us in to the Allianz because of the magnitudes of the game, which they lost to Leipzig as well. But so the alternative was Unterhaching, who I think 20 years ago they were in the Bundesliga, but they've fallen on hard times and they're now in like the Bavarian League. But I'd calculated that it's the last home game of the season, so I was sort of hoping they might have a trophy lift or something, and they did have a trophy lift, and we managed to get onto the pitch after the game with the trophy, celebrating with the players. Loads of ale. It was absolutely brilliant. It was like, it reminded me of sort of why you want to watch football, really, because there was no sort of showy element to it. It was just, you know, loads of people celebrating a great moment for the club. But it was short of getting into the changing rooms. That would have made it even better, I think. And I think if we'd asked, they'd have probably let us in. But it was a great couple of hours.
What was that giant ticker to see? Was that
for you? Oh, yeah. So my mate Mark, whose stag it was, we tried to do a series of very sort of, I'd say, minor wind-ups, and one of them was to buy him a massive ticket. So when he had to go through the turnstile, he had to unfold this huge ticket just to make him look like a bit of a knobhead, basically. But the guy on the turnstile found it very funny anyway, and I just let him through.
It sounds like he had a good weekend.
Yeah, it was
great. It's probably better than we did. staying here and watching the Villa game, but moving on swiftly.
To join our community of listeners on Facebook, just search Walk On Podcast and join the group.
Let's get back to Liverpool. James, where did the season go wrong? I always throw these questions at you, don't I? Unanswerable questions. You know, that.
Where did it go wrong?
He's having acupuncture today over, aren't you, James?
It's not even helping. I don't think it's possible to pick one particular moment. I think it was just a whole succession of factors coming together. The alarm bells were ringing, weren't they, right from Craven Cottage on the opening day of the season. The errors, how easily Fulham cut through that midfield.
Pretty much
all the themes of that day turned out to be themes of the season, even though coming away that day, you just think, oh, it's just a bit of rustiness on the opening weekend or whatever. But then, yeah, the more you look upon it, the more you thought, well, actually, that hangover from the previous season, the 63 games, toyed with the fact that obviously there was this, you know, will they, won't they strength in the midfield in August when the injuries just kept on stacking up and up and up. You know, it was like, no, we're sticking to our guns. We've got a long-term plan. We don't do short-term fixes. Then bang, you bring in Arthur Melo on deadline day. And, you know, that's obviously turned out disastrously for all parties. A bit of a shock he wasn't part of the Guard of Honour last weekend at Anfield.
I mean, you know, I thought at least we'd see him on the pitch there.
No, well, it was, I when you dig out his video with the club website when he first joined, and he talked about, you know, what an honour it was playing at Anfield when he came on for Barcelona in the iconic 4-0 game, and said, you know, I can't believe I'm now going to experience it as a home player. And of course he hasn't, because his solitary 13 minutes of football, ironically, was in Italy, where he'd obviously just come from in that Champions League defeat to Napoli, and never been seen since. So,
the lack played of in transfer. The best game at Anfield he could have.
Yes.
Not for Liverpool.
And he got a handshake off Pep Guardiola, didn't he, at the Etihad?
Yeah, so that was probably maybe his highlight of anything.
Yeah, I think he was just chuffed that Pep recognised him. I think it's just lots and lots of different factors coming together. And I mean, injuries, Liverpool have lost more days to injuries than any other Premier League club over the course of the season. For a group that were used to winning, suffering so many setbacks, I think sat morale, and Klopp for a long time was struggling to come up with the answers. And then, you know, belatedly, he managed to get them going again. But unfortunately, too late to really salvage something in terms of Champions League football.
Yeah. I mean, Kiefer, do you think we can be convinced that Klopp has actually turned it around and got them moving in the right direction again?
I think so. I think from the past however many games and the performances sort of came crashing down a little bit at home to Villa, didn't it? But I still think there was enough on show in the past few weeks to make us feel positive going into this new season. I think just the fact that, you know, new signings will come because they have to. If they don't, then, you know, Liverpool are just going to keep on falling away. So that will happen. But it has been a season that you've sort of kind of been a point. You mentioned the 7-0, like probably the highlight of the season. There's been points that have been good, but then pretty much for a lot of it, we've just been thinking, when will it end? And I'm absolutely fascinated to know any and all of Si Hughes's thoughts. And we've missed your rant, so I mean...
Exactly, and
rant's a bit of a...
Watching from
professional, you know,
watching from the sidelines, though. I mean, you must have had a number of views, and we want to hear them all now.
Well, I suppose I've seen it in a very different way to any point in the past, really, in the sense that I haven't been working on it, so I haven't seen it from a really critical point of view. But I haven't been going, you know, as a fan with me mates, so I haven't seen it from an emotional view. I've just seen it rather coldly, and I just think, from the first game of the season, Liverpool just haven't looked prepared, whether it's physically, tactically, you know, in terms of squad size. The concerning thing for me is that you will probably say that Alisson has had a good season, not an outstanding season. You would say Salah has had a good season by his own standards, not an outstanding season. But every single other player largely has way underperformed. So the manager hasn't got a tune really out of many of the players. I think Trent has shown signs of promise as the season's gone on, but I do have big question marks over, you know, this new shape that they're playing, whether, you know, they'll really be able to execute that against top quality opposition I mean, I think you just sort of look back to that Tottenham game when second half, it was quite clear that Ryan Mason just said to Son, you go and stand over on the left-hand side of the pitch and run up and down. And they got the three goals back. And that's not Trent's fault or Konate's fault. It's just the fact that there's so much space out there to exploit. So in the long term, whether they'll continuously be able to do that, you know, because it's just, you know, football is about space in a lot of ways. So, I mean, I think Liverpool have finished the season well. But my concern is that next season, I think the new signs that are coming in are going to have to probably hit the ground running to ensure that Liverpool get back into the Champions League positions. The big thing for me is I don't think United have had to be particularly good to get into the Champions League this season.
And
Liverpool have fallen well short this season. And I know people are talking about transition, but I think in that transition, they performed poorly.
Yeah. But, notwithstanding that, you look at how narrow the margins are from getting in the Champions League. You know, what would have taken another 6 points? And they've thrown away how many? Like 560 or something?
Yeah. I think that's the thing, isn't it? Sometimes over a season you can pick maybe one or two games, especially when Liverpool have missed out on the title by such narrow margins, but you're almost nitpicking when they've been so good for so much of a season. But this season, as you said, you know, you could, off the top of your head, you could easily pick 5, 6, 7 matches where you think, you know, what a waste that game was. You know, the killer was, you know, how on earth do you go from smashing United 7-0 to losing at Bournemouth the following weekend? I mean, that is unforgivable in terms of, and that does come down to mentality as much as anything. You know, that is just, you know, complete complacence.
And that for me is the worry that, you know, the one thing with Klopp's teams, you know, the mentality monsters have become one of the biggest cliches ever. The mentality wasn't there.
I was just going to say about that Bournemouth game, I think that was the game where you thought, well, they're not going to do it here. I think the team selection on that day was poor by the manager, really. I think, obviously, they had a resounding win the previous week. They had a Real Madrid second leg coming up. He chose, I think, two young midfielders in an away game, in a game where, you know, they had the momentum in the ascendancy. If they win that game, they're getting really close to where they want to be. And it was just a really passive performance, not by those two players, but I just think it would have fired up. It seemed to me to fire up Bournemouth when they looked at the team sheet and one or two key players were left out.
They're not taking us seriously.
They're not taking it as seriously as they should have done. So it's easy to, I suppose, to point at Sal and say, well, he missed that pen. But I just thought it sends out the wrong messages for me, that game, the team selection. The other one for me that sort of from afar that I'm watching it, I'm still intrigued to see how he develops his Nunes, and I'm sure you've spoken about him a lot, but you know, if you really
never mentioned him.
If you really dilute the season, I mean, is it too simplistic to say that he's had an okay season, but if he scores even half of the chances that he's had, Liverpool probably do get in the Champions League, and given the money they've spent on him, you'd be expecting them to have a bigger impact than he has. I can understand like the excitement around him because he is an exciting player to watch, but I'm still not quite sure where he fits into the structure of a Klopp team. Obviously, in the run that they've had, he hasn't played him largely. So it's a lot of money to be spending on a player who seems to me to be not quite certain of his best position still. So for me, if Nunes does well and sort of scores the number of goals that he probably should be scoring for the amount of money that he's spent, Liverpool in the Champions League, and we're probably not having this discussion.
Fair enough, and I think you're right there. This is Walk On, brought to you by The Athletic.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Kiva, the summer rebuild. All right, let's just say it here now. I don't think we should be thinking about a title race next season, no matter how they rebuild. I don't think that, given the state of the squad at the moment, bringing in two or three players will put them in a position for the title race. It's the Champions League they've got to get back in, isn't it?
And I think that should be the focus. If you look at, I think it was Adam Ramsdale for Arsenal, you know, speaking after they lost to Forest at the weekend, and he was saying, you know, our objective was to get in the Champions League, and obviously we've done that, but then, you know, they've fallen short now and whatever, lost the league title to Man City. And I do think, you know, Liverpool need to go into next season just focusing on, we need to get back in the Champions League and then see what comes from that. Because like Si mentions there, it feels like this has been a transitional season. Next season will be as well, because there'll be potentially a new midfield there as well to work off. This isn't the end of the transition. It doesn't just stop with all these signings coming in, because, you know, the signings that come in last summer, they're still technically finding the feet. We've seen Cody Gakpo do his thing and find his feet quite well. Going into next season, it'll be about having every player at the best. And I think Si mentioned it when he said about Alisson's been amazing, Salah's been amazing, but has that amazing been enough for two players can't do it all?
I said good. They've been good. They've been good, but not like truly outstanding.
Not the level of where they need to be.
Propel Liverpool to a point where the performances are that good that it takes over.
Do you not think Alisson's been better than good? I think he's been outstanding for most of it. I'd say he's player of the year by
I'd say he's player of the year,
by far.
Been a lot more exposed as well, defensively.
Yeah, I think he has been exposed. He has made a few errors as well, which I suppose he has done in every single season.
Yeah.
But ultimately, the point is, whether it's good or outstanding, having your goal, if your goalkeeper's outstanding, it's not a good sign.
Your alarm bells are ringing, yeah.
And generally, when you see goalkeepers who are outstanding, it's because they've got loads of work to do. And James, does this make it more important? Like, you know, we've talked about Nunes coming in, and obviously he's adjusting to a new country. He's adjusting to a new league. We know it's difficult for people to make the transition to the Premier League because of its physicality and all that. Does that make it more important that the buys they do this summer are not like Nunes-style punts from the continent, but players who've proved they can actually play in the Premier League?
Yeah, and I don't think it's any coincidence that is why, you know, Alexis McAllister and Mason Mount are so high up on the list of targets for this window, because they both tick that box, don't they, in terms of being Premier League proven. So you would hope that that does negate that argument of, you know, needing that adaptation period. And you know, of course, it's not always as simple as that. You know, players sometimes still need, you know, time to adjust. Or even Adam Lallana would be an example of that, who's someone who didn't light the place up for probably 6 months after he made the move to Liverpool. But yeah, that is the situation Liverpool are in, aren't they? That they need to go and buy proven quality. And where, you know, it's okay to say, well, Darwin Nunes was a long-term plan and an investment for the future. But yeah, Liverpool need ready-made individuals to come in and instantly improve that team, because, you know, you need a minimum of two players who go walk straight into that midfield, I think, in terms of becoming regular starters. I think if you probably, you know, I'd expect Liverpool to sign three midfielders. The third one, I think, could be a bit of a work in progress, maybe a younger talent that you need to develop. But the other two need to be the finished article. I know what you said before about top four being the priority next season, but I still think you add two elite midfielders to that team, and I still think that Liverpool can be title challengers next season. There's still a lot of talent there, but that's why this summer's so big in terms of taking the team on to the next level.
The problem with the title race is, as we've seen this year with Arsenal, there's just no margin for error, is it? But I mean, Simon, you know, this appointment we've been talking about, Jörg Schmadtke. One day I'll get it right.
I think that's right.
Well, as I say, I always say there is an injunction forbidding me for attempting to pronounce foreign names. So, you know, but I mean, the sporting director role, how important do you think that is?
That touches on something else that I wanted to say, really, is that obviously there's a lot of attention on the team and the players and who they get in midfield to replace players that have served Liverpool well. But it's still important what happens off the pitch as well, that they get that right. And there's a lot of unanswered questions, I'd say, there at the moment, whether it's, you know, you mentioned Jörg Schmadeke. He's obviously replacing Julian Ward, who I think Liverpool had hopes that he'd be staying a lot longer. You know, clearly there's a reason why Julian Ward is leaving the club. He's chosen to do that. I wrote about it just before I went off on paternity in December. So sort of the recruitment side of things, all a little bit up in the air. I mean, the team that had served Liverpool quite well and had balanced quite well, had the balance very well with Jurgen Klopp, has been dismantled at a time when you're trying to refresh the team. So that is going to, they're going to have to get these decisions right. You know, there's been some big personnel changes there. Meanwhile, you know, we've spoken about injuries. You know, I wrote about the medical departments at the start of the season. You know, they're going to have to improve the availability rates one way or the other, whether it's on the players themselves or the better decision making or, you know, technology, whatever. You know, so there's a lot of things that, for me, aren't as settled that need to be for Liverpool to really be, you know, as good as they have been.
Just picking up on that, how important do you think Mike Gordon not being around, because he was taken off to try and sell the club, which he didn't manage to do, but now he's back involved more on a day-to-day basis?
Well, I think I'll stick by what I said or wrote in December. It was when Julian Ward was offered the chance to replace Michael Edwards, he was told that there wouldn't be a great deal of change, you know, it'd just be sort of this seamless transition. Unfortunately, you know, sort of that didn't prove to be the case, really. Mike Gordon, over, you know, a long period of time, has been a good sounding board for Jurgen Klopp, who I would say takes away his worst instincts, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
His most combative instincts that maybe if you're working with him day after day after day, people quite find quite hard to deal with. And Julian Ward sort of felt the job wasn't the one that he was told it was going to be. So he's obviously gone. Mike Gordon has since returned. He's now back in place. I think it's important that he is, because it gives Klopp a good sounding board, somebody to go to in these situations where he might not be quite getting what he wants. You know, he was reporting to, you know, sort of Billy Hogan took on that role a bit, but nobody quite filled that space while Mike Gordon wasn't there. So, but nevertheless, you know, they're still getting a sporting director who's working, who's sort of being parachuted in at relatively short notice to sort of oversee very important periods. And I just sort of hope FSG appreciate that. There seems to be a feeling, not just, you know, I'd say generally across the fan base, and I can understand why this happens, is that Jurgen Klopp's achieved so many great things for Liverpool. It's like, well, he'll just sort it all out now. But it's not quite as simple as that. I mean, I think that I was always quite critical of Michael Edwards when he first came in. But I think where Edwards benefited from Klopp was that Klopp's sort of way of working and his tactical approach was so clear that it made it a lot easier for Edwards to do his job well. Meanwhile, Edwards is obviously an effective operator, and there were things that he did that made Klopp's decision making a lot better as well.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
they were a good working
relationship.
They balanced
each other, didn't they? They took the worst aspects of each other's game.
I'd say so, yeah.
Each other's way of working, and it worked. And Kiva, you know, the thing is, you know, and people always look at the players, look at the manager, but invariably, when there's chaos either in the boardroom or behind the scenes, you see the symptoms on the pitch, don't you?
I think that's the key word for me. A lot of the time this season has been uncertainty since, you know, Liverpool are up for sale, and it's like, oh no, just actually going to sell, like, you know, to shareholders or whatever, not sell the whole club. And that message sort of like diluted itself, didn't it? And he wasn't quite clear on, you know, what was actually happening. And then, you know, different people leaving the club and roles haven't quite been filled, or they're getting filled now, but it doesn't maybe feel like, you know, it's all sort of happened in not necessarily the right way, but the just sort of, it hasn't come together off the pitch in the way, you know, I think we'd imagine. And in the period of success for Jurgen Klopp, everything behind the scene seemed to be,
we seemed to have certainty, didn't we?
Things just seemed to tick well, didn't they?
Yeah.
And now there's, like, you know, things are happening off the pitch. And I think that does draw your attention to, on the pitch, sorry, and that does draw your attention to behind the scenes. And I'm just off to make a cocktail, so I'll be right back.
Yeah.
Or get one, sorry.
We know there's going to be a big shake-up at Anfield this summer, but there's a big shake-up in here at the moment. Regarding all this stuff, we've had an email from Kevin Garford, And he says, been enjoying the pub for the last few weeks, just started listening. Thanks, Kevin. Carry on listening. You should have been listening earlier, but we'll let that one go for the minute. Anyway, just got a quick question with regards to the summer, says Kevin. I heard James talking about signings and the spinning plate scenario, and he mentioned a guess of the numbers involved, cost-wise. No one seems to be mentioning how are we going to be able to afford this, as we have no one currently that we can sell for a big price. And we know during Fenway Sports Group time at the club, we only spend big if we sell players. The talk of investment's gone quieter than a home game at the Etihad. Cruel, cruel, cruel. So can we ask James and the rest, where's the rebuild money coming from? James, come on, where's the rebuild money? You know.
This is a bit like, where's the Arteta money? Isn't it?
Well, for a start, you'd have to say that when Liverpool were clearly in need of midfield reinforcements last summer, the argument was, no, we're going to sit tight and wait because who we really want isn't available at the moment. We can't get the right players in. So that immediately insinuates the money was there last summer, so that money should still be there this summer. And yes, of course, for a club with a self-sustaining business model, missing out on Champions League has an impact financially, but it's not quite as simple as all that, because you know, when you look at the numbers, you've got, you know, for a start, you've got the Anfield redevelopment that's going to be completed come August. You know, the financial benefits of an extra 7,000 seats every home game, the new Standard Chartered shirt sponsorship deal kicks in this summer, the new, I think it's Expedia sleeve sponsorship deal, that kicks in on more improved terms. The Nike deal is starting to now generate the kind of money that Liverpool hoped it would do when they went across from New Balance. So I think, you know, everyone's waiting with bated breath, aren't they, really, to see what kind of numbers that does mean that Klopp is going to be able to play with financially this summer. But yeah, it's not going to be, there isn't a Coutinho type, is there, that's going to be sold to generate a huge fee that then you can go and buy, you know, like they did with Van Dijk and Alisson. That's just simply not the case. You know, maybe Quirin Kelleher, that was probably the most saleable asset, although I know Klopp last week said it would take an extraordinary offer. I also think from the conversations I've had with the ownership, that regardless of Champions League or not Champions League, they acknowledge that in this phase of where Liverpool are at in terms of the refreshing of the squad and the rebuild, that there is some serious investment that's required. You know, that wasn't the reason why they dropped out the running for Bellingham. The reason they dropped out the running for Bellingham was it was like, well, 120 odd million, which is what it's going to take to get him. That is effectively a vast, vast chunk of the kitty. And can we really justify that on one player when anyone with a brain knows that squad needs probably three or four minimum reinforcements this summer? And they also had no guarantees from Bellingham that his first choice was Liverpool anyway, even if they could have done that deal. So I'm still pretty optimistic that we'll see the show of ambition that we all want to see.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as you know, Simon, I've spoken quite a lot to John Henry over the years, and he always said...
Your mate, John.
Yeah, Johnny Boy, as I called him. Yeah, I called him some names at various times. But anyway, and he always said, yes, it's a self-sustaining model, but if they need it, there would be money available, particularly to Klopp, because obviously, sort of Brendan Rodgers really blotters a copybook. But, I mean, how do you see it?
Well, I think the other big thing is when we talk about football recruitments, wages is a big issue in Liverpool. Have just, as we know, let go of four big wage earners, two of which, you know, I would argue have probably been disappointments. The main disappointments of the Klopp era, Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain and Naby Keita.
You've got to let Ox off because he got injured.
Yeah.
But that's for Keita.
Keita, given the fanfare that he came with.
Keita got injured a few times as well.
Yeah, like always.
Yeah. Well, the other thing as well this season, you know, they haven't qualified for the Champions League, so I think there'll be, you know, some of the players that they're keeping on, their wages won't be as high as they were last season because they're heavily incentivized as well. So that will become an issue, you know, when they're recruiting players. I think that's pretty significant.
These are businessmen. They're not stupid. Liverpool makes a fair amount of money as a club itself, so you can invest that. But if they really need to put extra money in, I think they will.
I think they will, but I think Jurgen Klopp would be quite within his right to remind them. It's like, well,
when I've had money to spend in the past, albeit, you know, goes back to what we were talking before about like recruitment and sort of the guidance that Klopp, I suppose, was getting. Alisson Becker was not a Klopp signing. It was, you know, the recruitment team that was put in place, which is no longer there. You know, he was a transformative signing for Liverpool. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But I think Jürgen Klopp, you know, can say, well, I think I deserve a little bit of backing at this stage, you know, given everything that he's achieved at the club. But I think there'll be maybe one or two departures this summer as well, which might surprise people potentially to ensure that, you know, the tactical reshape of the team is more seamless. I mean,
you can't just throw that in and then walk away from it.
I saw the story today. Again, this is not me sort of with any inside knowledge, but I saw the story today about Andy Robertson potentially being available. Now,
that's nonsense.
Do you think that's nonsense?
Absolute nonsense, yeah.
As he denied that. So you can exclusively say that it's
correct, yeah.
Nonsense today?
Yes.
Because it would have made sense for me on some levels, given the structure of the team now.
Well, Liverpool need to be more wise in selling players when they're at the most profitable as well, don't they?
Because
someone who's 29, is he now?
Because what you don't really want...
As much as you don't want to see Liverpool play without Andy Robertson, because Tsimikas is great, but you want Andy Robertson starting the game.
I think that they need, arguably in the system that they've got, somebody who's a bit more closer to a left-sided centre-back than a left-back now. So I could understand maybe where that story's come from to some degree. But I think sort of the scenes that we saw last weekend where you're getting four players getting big farewells is exactly the sort of thing that FSG, really, given their business model, do not want to see.
No, definitely.
You know, it's like they should be getting moved on earlier where they're making money and they're replenishing it. So I understand why sort of fans that, you know, want to celebrate Firmino and everybody else, but really, if the business model is going to work,
it's almost like a failure.
It's a failure, really. It's a symbol of the failure, I would say. And serious questions should be asked why that's being allowed to take place.
Yep.
You know, whether it's in the recruitment level, management level, who's having too much influence. That should not, in the future, that should not be allowed, in my view. If they're going to make a success out of this, players, particularly in the 20s, leaving for nothing that they spent 80 million quid on. You know, that could be funding Jude Bellingham, really. So
could be funding our cocktails.
Oxley Chamberlain. Yeah. I guess the awkward thing is, and we touched upon this earlier in the week, is there were no offers for them last summer. As much as you probably, I think it's definitely a fair argument to say, well, why were they kept on for one more year?
Yeah.
But it was like, you've still got to have the offers on the table to be able to cash in. And I think the reality was there wasn't a market for either of them last summer.
You could argue, somebody might say, well, could have sold them two or three summers ago, really. You know, they probably clung on to them for far too long in the long term. Serious questions, not like, you know, when I say serious questions, not like sort of you're getting sacked for this, but I do think that
you're putting
they need
the
to
finger,
be
sir. You're putting
they,
the finger.
They need to be. It needs to be debated why they're having a big send off for four players,
two of which
naturally you'd be expecting to get money out of in the business model. At
as well, though, just speaking about like Robertson, you can't imagine him not playing for Liverpool. But in a way, would this summer benefit from the odd shock of a player, you know, of a high profile that you couldn't imagine Liverpool's first 11 being without going technically to help fund whatever comes?
It'll be interesting
to see if that does happen. Like,
that's a really, really good point. And you know what? It's great that Kevin got in touch with us because he started all this debate and we've just talked and talked and talked about it. So if you want to get in touch, email walk-on@theathletic.com. This is Walk On from The Athletic, and we're going to have a quick break because our glasses are empty.
In towards Gerrard! Oh. Hello! Hello! Here we go!
This is Walk On from The Athletic with me, Tony Evans, James Pearce, Kiefer O'Neill and Simon News.
Liverpool have their hands on the European Cup again, and this time it's for keeps. That trophy isn't going anywhere but Anfield.
18 years since Istanbul. Can you believe that? It's mind-boggling, really. And I have to say, I've seen a lot of Liverpool games in my life, but that was an experience unlike anything ever. I mean, I was lucky. I went by train, left Liverpool on Thursday night, got into Istanbul like 8 o'clock in the morning on Monday morning, have four wild teas in Turkey, and then got the train out at 10 o'clock on the Thursday night. And the whole thing, it turned into a really life-affirming journey. And when we were 3-0 down, I was fuming. Kiva, you know, you're the youngest of us all here. How do you see it? Because it must be weird, because 18 years on, there's a whole generation of Liverpool fans who, you know, would have been very young and wouldn't, you know, maybe don't get the resonance of it.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it always felt like, I always said, like, that was the best night of my life. Obviously, I wasn't there, but I was, you know, on my little street in Birkenhead of all my mates, just, like, dreaming, I guess, before the game. And then the game happens, and obviously Liverpool go 3-0 down. You're like, oh, OK. Because you kind of... It's weird because I think back and think, I didn't really even know what the European Cup was. You know, I was in, like, year 7 or 8 in school, and I didn't really understand it, but I kind of knew we were good at it. And, like, my granddad had, like, told me stories, and it was his birthday, actually. I think he was in Benidorm, and we later got a nice phone call. So it was, he'd be 86 on the 25th.
What an auspicious day to have your birthday, the 25th of May, the anniversary of the first European Cup, the anniversary of the fifth European Cup. Brilliant.
I mean, he loves a bevy, so he's, yeah, definitely loved a bevy on those days. But yeah, so I've sort of, you know, grew up with those stories and knowing that it was like this special coveted thing, but never really truly probably understanding it. And then all of the games to get there, I remember watching and just being like excited about it. Then you get there and then it's like, whoa, didn't know Liverpool were this bad, like, you know, 3-0 down. And then I think in the second half, obviously the whole Gerrard arms up and just like, you know, it begins, doesn't it? And I think we locked my mum in the back garden because she went out there to like do some gardening, and we were like, you can't come back in now. It was all very superstitious, and like we were all sort of praying almost in like a, you stay there and that'll happen for us. And then I think we sort of ended the night in my mum's cousin Harry. We ended the night in his house, like yeah, I just remember feeling like this is amazing. And I think I always look back on that night thinking that was the night when it was like, you know, this is what the club means. This is what Liverpool can do. So, you know, it's never over until it's over. And it's something that I think you look back on and it is truly just a very special occasion. And then, you know, 2019, I get to be there in Madrid and sort of, you know, be that little girl and the woman and see it happen. And I think that was sort of a nice full circle moment for me.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant. I was, what was amazing, the ground was in the middle of nowhere. Obviously, a lot of you won't have been in the Atatürk. It's the middle of nowhere, in a moor. And obviously, the whole Liverpool fan base was dressed for summer. And we walked across this big moor, and all of a sudden it got freezing after kickoff. So you're in your T-shirt, you're 3-0 down, and my phone was besieged with texts from Manx and Evertonians, like gloating at half-time. And one come through. It said to me, it just said, God's good. And I didn't know what it was from. It was just a number. And like about 5 or 6 hours later, from a bar in Istanbul, I texted them back and said, isn't he just? But James, it was one of the most remarkable nights, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Hard to believe, isn't it? That's 18 years ago already. I remember a couple of years back now, wouldn't it? Do you remember, Simon, you put together that kind of oral history and spoke to most of the players involved? And sometimes you have to kind of remind yourself just how extraordinary it was. And I think the fact it's stood the test of time as well, isn't it? Because nothing has beaten it since. And I don't think anything will ever will, certainly not like in my lifetime. Because, yeah, to do it on that stage against such an incredible Milan team. And whenever I look back over that game, you look at the names on that Milan team sheet, and it, with the greatest respect, you compare them to the ones on the other one, and you think, it's just outrageous that to come back from 3-0 down as well. And yeah, it's a little bit bittersweet for me, actually, because I turned down a ticket the day before. I was actually in the process of moving to Liverpool. So I was working on the Bath Chronicle newspaper at the time. I'd just taken quite a big pay cut to go from the Bath newspaper to the Echo, just as a kind of general sports reporter. And a mate of mine, we tried to get tickets and it hadn't been fortunate enough. And then like the day before, he said, I've managed to get two. The other one's yours if you want it. And you know, you're looking at flights and price. I was looking at about $2,000 by that point. And I just genuinely did not have $2,000, unfortunately, at that time. So I watched it in a bar in Clifton in Bristol. with loads of mates, which was still amazing, but obviously not quite as good as it could have been. And one of those ones where, you know, at half time you're thinking, thank God I didn't mortgage the house to get myself over there for that. Yet come the end of it, you're thinking, I'd have sold my grand to be able to say that I was there tonight.
Yeah, Simon, you were there, weren't you?
No.
No, I wasn't. Am I the only one who was there?
I've got a similar tale of woe. So I was in my last year of university, right, and got on this. The next morning, I had my last exam.
Oh.
How cruel is that? So what happened was, I remember when they got through from the semi-final, I went to my lecturer and tried to make a compelling case that he should let me take the exam earlier than everybody else and escort me to the airport, which I'd pay him to do, and then go. Obviously, it was never going to work, but I had convinced myself he might buy into it, but no chance. So I
fascist.
Well, the only sort of good side, well, one of the good sides to it was that, like, some of my mates who live in Crosby, like, which is a couple of miles north of Liverpool, we ended up all watching it together in the pub. I remember, like, one of my mates who's a Blue, he sort of sidled over to me at half time, and he's a good lad. I'll name him Andy Taylor. Good lad, Andy. He's very rational when it comes to football. I just remember him coming over to me saying, Seedorf's absolutely killing you there. Like, I remember saying to him, I did actually say to him, I said, he did surrender the 3-goal leads at La Coruña last year. Yeah. But it was like, it was in vain. It was just this little thing that I just thought I'd say. And then anyway, he was nowhere to be seen when the 3rd goal went in. I think he'd gone home. Yeah, so I did they won the Champions League, and I remember toddling off home, getting up the next morning. I remember my dad gave me a lift into town, and Liverpool was like this sort of post-apocalyptic world.
It's amazing.
I remember it being dead bright, dead early, really warm, people staggering about, like, what the hell has just happened here? So it was interesting to see Liverpool as a city waking up as having a Champions League winner. But I just think the great thing about it is that no matter what, on a football pitch, you never quite know what's going to happen.
Oh.
You know, because at half time, even though I said what I said to me, mate, who's a Blue, AC Milan was so good. He was so good the first half, and Liverpool were humbled. I never for a minute thought he'd even get a goal. So I think it should be a message for everybody that, like, if you just hang in there and... It's a strange sport, football. I mean,
I think when you grow up as well, you look at that team now. That team is ridiculous. Like, I wouldn't have even, like you saying about them squandering a 3-0 lead, like, I wouldn't have knew any of that, but I didn't really know about Pirlo or Maldini or, you know, any of these players until I was older. And I'm like, Liverpool did that. Like, that is just phenomenal that actually happened, that is real.
Well, how does
Istanbul
it rank? Everybody who went to Istanbul will never be defeated, but on a personal level, I would say I enjoyed Barcelona in 2019 more because I was there and I was involved on a personal level. I remember coming out to the Nou Camp in 2019 and just thinking, Messi is the best player that I've ever seen in my life. You know, like, by a million miles.
He's no Jimmy Traore.
So, I don't know. That's how I console myself, I think.
Well, I think, you know, different games have different resonance for different generations, obviously. And what was so particularly important and moving for me in Istanbul is, first of all, we didn't expect it. But was also the 20th anniversary of Heysel that year. Obviously, we had to look back. And I got back from the morning after Heysel. Got back into Britain, and when I heard the news that 39 people had been killed, I thought to myself, I will never see another European Cup final again. I'll never see another, you know, what became the Champions League then. And then, of course, in that mad ride, in that first half of 2005, not only do we get to Istanbul to the final, but it goes through Juventus, who obviously were the team we played in Heysel. And, you know, predominantly those who died were Juventus fans. And that was a very difficult thing as well. I mean, I spent 3 very uncomfortable days in Turin, you know, because of that. And then, but you go through, and then suddenly, something that you never believed would happen to you happens. And not only that, happens for a point where you're standing there at half time going, I was just going, please, just don't be humiliated. Keep it at 3, don't be humiliated. And then that famous moment when everyone started singing You'll Never Walk Alone. And it wasn't like sentimental or anything. It was quite the opposite. It was like, right, I'll tell you what, we've come all this way.
Paid all this money.
Yeah, they've embarrassed us. But you know what? This is who we are, sodgers. And, you know, that moment where Stephen turns around and rouses the crowd. I've said this before on the podcast. My reaction was, hey, you, I don't need lessons in support from you. Get on with it.
You know, he got on with it.
He did get on with it. And the other really surreal experience for me was I was in a bar around Taxim Square about 5 a.m. and this massive sort of tsunami of emotions had drowned me, and I was like, I didn't know where, and I was like, and the highlights come up as well like that. And when Alonso stepped up to take the penalty, I'd forgotten it was saved. So when the keeper saved it, I nearly fainted. I thought it was like in a nightmare. Like, you know, it's like, and then he put the rebound in, and my heart was going bum, 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 bum. But even now, I can't watch the Shevchenko chance.
Oh, what a save! What a save from Shevchenko by Jerzy Dudek.
That save by Dudek is unexplainable.
Yeah,
that's like one of the seven miracles of
it is
the universe.
The trajectory of the ball, no matter how many times he tried that again, that would never happen again.
I think there was great commentary as well on it was ITV, wasn't it, showing that night. There's Clive Tilsley,
yeah,
when Gerrard pumps his arms up, he says hello, here we go. And that just, I feel like that was like almost like something that just followed me around for years, like, you know. You just, anytime Liverpool would score, you just think, hello, here we go. Just holding on to that, like. And then obviously when Alonso does get the rebound of the penalty, I think, does he say mission impossible is complete or something? And it did feel that way, didn't it? It felt like that penalty going in.
You had so many great subplots. And you had Traore was in the shower at half-time and been told, you know, you're off. Traore was in the shower, and then it was like, Finnan had a muscle injury. So then it was, Rafa was like, someone's got to go and get Traore out the shower. And he brings on Didi Haman. And, you know, I can't think of another example in football history where bringing on a defensive midfielder has transformed a game like bringing on Didi Haman that night. And even like, you know, Vladimir Smica doesn't really get too much of a mention in all the kind of heroic tales from that night. But you speak to Vladimir Smica and he was leaving the club and he'd been left out. He wasn't even on the bench for the final league game at Anfield.
Yeah.
And he was furious because he was like, you know, I haven't even had the chance. You know, I just wanted that chance to say goodbye to Anfield. So he didn't even expect to be on the bench in Istanbul, let alone come on.
This is the thing. This is what I love about it is, you know, like football now, everybody's attempting to explain everything that happens in football, whether it's, you know, through data or, you know, recruitment or whatever.
Yeah.
I do not think, no matter how hard you try, you can ever explain what happened in Istanbul, whether it's a combination of lots of things. You know, everybody was sort of hanging on what was said in the dressing room at half-time. Yeah. Nothing particularly remarkable by the sounds of it.
And the confusion, the famous story, Rafa putting up 10 names on the team board and then putting 12 because of all the confusion.
Even had a play, didn't he, in the 15 minutes of Chuck the World or whatever. Yeah.
It's one of football's great mysteries, even though it's probably one of the most famous moments.
Barros getting out of the way of Smita's shot. Like, does it touch him? Does it not? Like, it doesn't matter, but it's everything's unexplainable and it doesn't need to be explained, like
when,
you say.
When
like
the ball
that.
Goes to Smita, I'm shouting, don't shoot from there. Oh, okay, that worked.
Well, Kat Carragher, I think, has gone on record, hasn't he, saying that he's never been so high up the pitch in a game, you know, when he contributes towards the penalty that gets given. It's like, you know, why is he there at that moment in time? There's still, you know, 30 to 35 minutes left to go and he's trying to get an equaliser. Like, it's a freak, but that's why, you know, that's what keeps us hanging on, I think.
You know what? And we'll see stuff like this again, because the one thing supporting Liverpool Football Club has taught me all my life is that strange things happen and they're normally for the good. That's all from Walk On, your Liverpool podcast brought to you by The Athletic. Thanks to James, Kiever and Simon, and you as well for joining us. We'll be back on Monday. We'll catch you then.
The Athletic.